May I have your attention, please?
Your attention, please?
Good afternoon, and welcome to Attention, Please. KPTZ airs Attention, Please each Monday at noon and at 5, and on Saturdays at noon to bring your attention to the good work that is being done to strengthen our community and reinforce its resilience. I'm Phil Andrus. Topic today on Attention, Please is the Far Reaches Botanical Conservancy, and with me are its co-founders and its present co-directors, Kelly Dodson and Sue Milliken. So welcome to you both.
Thanks, Phil. Nice to be here.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. Good to see you. Good to meet you. By way of introduction, I'm going to read the mission statement from your website. Then we're going to get back to it kind of piece by piece as we go. The mission of the Conservancy is to facilitate the acquisition and introduction to North America of threatened and vulnerable ornamental plants of known wild provenance as well as from cultivated sources. These plants will be maintained as a living resource, a reference collection for public educational and scientific purposes with the goal of conservation. Through cultivation via distribution to botanic and public gardens, botanists and researchers, plus professional and amateur gardeners and horticulturists. You've done well writing that for me to read it. Straight from your website.
You did a good job reading it.
And you saved us some time there. Thank you.
You must have known I was coming. So I want to take that apart. But first, general questions. The Conservancy, when and where was it founded?
We founded the Conservancy in the fall of 2017, right here.
And whose idea was it, and what prompted you to do such a thing?
Well, that's a great question. We bought the property in 2000, and we started a nursery, a rare plant nursery here. Sue and I both had nurseries in our previous lives, so to speak, and when we got together, through meeting on a seed collecting expedition in China in 1997.
Which is a whole story that we don't have time to get into now, but it was quite a story.
Yeah,
but
probably better for later at night. So the nursery, as it evolved, and we did subsequent, you know, expeditions in the wild and developed a much more refined rare plant palette here at the nursery, it became apparent to us from seeing increasing habitat degradation and loss of plants in the wild from places that we had visited over, you know, 15 years even. And we saw the same thing happening in cultivated plants. Like when we go to England to nurseries and go to national collection holders and look at their plant collections, we could see a decline in sort of gardening interest. And it occurred to us that, you know, we've got a real significant sort of genetic repository of irreplaceable plants here at the nursery, and we need to set this up to preserve it after we're no longer involved. And so we thought, well, let's form a nonprofit and see if we can make this happen. And it's,
well, we were kind of formalizing the fact that nurseries are tend to be sort of nonprofits anyway.
That is true.
And so, and we're also always been more interested in the sort of the scientific end of things anyway, and just growing all these rare plants and rather than just growing anything that you'd see at a regular garden center. So it just seemed like a natural step in the right direction.
So I heard you say that you met on an expedition in China. So means that you had separate lives before your lives together. We don't necessarily need to get into that, but we may a little bit. What I do want to ask is, prior to meeting, prior to the Conservancy, individually, what were you doing both with respect to plants? And I'm going to say, I often say this to musicians, what was your day job?
Well, we both had day jobs that were very similar in that we both had small nurseries. And mine was on the East Coast, and Kelly's was out here on the West Coast. And so we've both been just plant nuts from kind of day one. Both of our parents loved to garden. And actually, Kelly had a small mail order nursery, and he put out a catalog, and I ordered plants from it. And so he had this just great range of plants in his little catalog, and I ordered plants. And
I remembered you specifically because I couldn't believe somebody
In
Vermont would be ordering these crazy, crazy plants.
Yeah, all these weird esoteric things that probably you'd never sold to anyone else.
So Sue was in Vermont and Kelly was where?
I was not too far away. I was in Paulsbo. A mutual friend of ours invited us to go on a plant collecting expedition that she was setting up in conjunction with Kunming Botanic Garden back in 1997. So neither one of us had ever been, and we'd always dreamed of doing such a thing. So I was jumped right on that.
Yeah, it was really amazing.
Why did you decide to establish your conservancy in Port Townsend, of all places, kind of out on the end of the world?
Well, we had the farm, Prairie Reaches Farm, here already. And honestly, Port Townsend is a wonderful community. We both have, you've visited it when you were
years. For my whole life, really.
Yeah. And I just happened to go through here many years ago, way before 2000, and on a bike trip, and just thought it was just a really neat little town. And so something about it just drew us both, and we just ended up being here. And we're lucky enough to find a piece of property here inside city limits. I've just never looked back.
So it would seem then that where you're located really doesn't matter. You could be anywhere in the world.
Well, you know, a good climate helps a lot. And, you know, we're the Pacific Northwest, on especially on the west of the mountains here, it's really one of the best gardening climates in the world. And comparatively cold right where we're at. We've got a cold little microclimate here. So in that sense, it's not ideal. But generally, except for that 1 week in the winter, which makes us not be San Francisco, you know, it's wonderful.
So why do you think we want these plants in North America? To what purpose?
First of all, these plants, you need, a constant influx of more plants to keep gardening interest going. So many things come, you know, like people say, well, why don't you grow natives? And we have, and not to besmirch our native plant population or our flora, but it's, especially on the West Coast, it's a West Side here, it's a little, it's not as rich as some other areas, so to speak.
For instance, it's richer in areas like alpine areas, which those plants aren't necessarily growable down at this elevation.
Unless
you give them special conditions.
Right, right. Yeah. But many of our most important ornamental plant species that we grow in our gardens or genera evolved in, say, China. For instance, magnolias, rhododendrons, primula, that sort of thing. And, you know, to be able to bring more species or hardier forms or better forms of these things into our gardens is just a really wonderful thing. And they're of value not only from a scientific standpoint for botanists and botanic gardens to have, but also for, you know, perhaps breeding work to provide more genetic information to create better plants for our gardens.
And also to researchers.
Correct.
Because we've actually distributed quite a few plants for scientific research for maybe they're doing something to help figure out why there's a disease on avocados. So we'll give them a member of that family that's resistant to maybe a disease or something like that. So
it's interesting the number of, because we do ship through the nursery, and plants from our conservancy are distributed through our nursery's website. So we ship all over the country. So we're not just limited to a local arena here, so to speak.
So I have grown a garden either in Seattle and now more recently, but not recently, 40 years or so, near Chimicum. And everything that I grow and everything that I've ever grown are things that I can eat. Mm. You specialize, if not exclusively specialize, in ornamentals. And I'm wondering why. I can't come to your nursery and find something to eat.
Oh, we'll feed you something. We have a few odd edibles, that's for sure. But yeah, that's not our focus. And
I think we all need more beauty that ornamental plants serve a purpose.
Well, and for us, gardening is an art form, and this is really kind of an extension of our art. You know, we are providing the raw material, so to speak, for making beautiful landscapes and a more aesthetically pleasing world in which we all can inhabit.
So what criteria do you use for choosing what you want to put into the conservancy, into your nursery, especially as you go about the world, because you do go about the world, finding species either that you've not known about or species that you've known about but never been able to collect? How do you decide what you want to keep in your nursery?
Well, the nursery, you know, we're looking for plants that we think are would be of interest to our customer base. For the conservancy, for the nonprofit, you know, we're looking for plants that have known, you know, if we are collecting them ourselves, we also get plants from other plant collectors. But the real important thing on anything from a wild origin is that it comes with collection data, because a wild plant without any history to it or reference information is kind of useless scientifically. And so we're...
Yeah, actually, the botanic gardens that we distribute to will not even accept material unless it has wild provenance.
So, yeah, we provide all that information to them. And that becomes part of the scientific record for that species. So what we try to do when we go out is to go to areas where there may not have been recent collecting in the modern area done. And we try to find new plants of the same species from a different area, plants from a higher elevation where they might be hardier, different forms of species. We've found several new species, which is quite interesting. So
I was wondering about that. When you find a new species, does that grant you naming rights?
We'll talk with we don't describe it ourselves. We hand all these off to different botanists, and they do that. Our preference is that either is the name for the region or locality where it was found, or a name for a particularly diagnostic plant feature, you know, that sets it apart from other related species.
I was thinking of names like Dobsonensis and melicensis, for example.
Well, if it was up to us, and it's a good thing we don't allow ourselves naming rights, because it'd be after all our pets. So
right. Yeah, I don't think our egos are big enough to name things after ourselves. And
you've traveled to faraway places. You met in China. Where else have you traveled in search of plants?
Different parts of Asia, not only China, but India and Vietnam and Bhutan and Taiwan, and a little bit into eastern Bhutan. Just before the pandemic started, we were in Argentina, so we have dipped our toes into the southern hemisphere a little bit.
We make frequent trips to the UK, too, because they've got a rich gardening tradition going back hundreds of years there.
Yeah, when you think about the UK, you think about all these plant hunters of old bringing material back in the 1800s, and then these plants are put into botanic gardens, or maybe some older person is holding a national collection with these plants, and they're in their 80s, and there's the possibility that those plants are not going to be around any much longer. So it's kind of like they're threatened in their locale, too.
And they've got so many ornamental plants over there that we don't have.
Yeah, they've got great things.
So you say gardening is an art. I'd like you to expand on that.
Well, it's the same sort of thing. It's three-dimensional sculpture. You're taking sort of related but disparate elements and combining color, form, texture, but also having to factor in growth rate, time of flower, time of fruiting, evergreen versus deciduous, even scent. And how is this all combining and playing together so that it's representing and creating an ongoing, pleasing, yet involved experience as the years go on.
So it seems if I were to come to your place, to your farm, I would find a conservancy, I would find a nursery, and I presume you live there, and I would find your private gardens, and I would find them an art form.
Yes, there are some aspects that are an art form.
Yeah,
there.
I think one of our latest art forms actually is we have what's called a crevice garden. We're going to be expanding it even more, but it's a type of garden where rocks are used sort of on edge and to create deep crevices. And then the soil is kind of a sandy, rocky soil. And
you can, like flat rocks on edge.
Like flat rocks on edge. And then you can grow plants that normally would not be able to be grown here, like some of those high alpines from our native Olympics or other places, because it creates this, the top of the plant is out in the sun, and then the long roots can get down into the cool rocks. And so it's really it's a beautiful garden, our crevice garden, because it's very sculptural.
It was built by North America's only two professional crevice garden installers who have just finished their book on crevice gardening. And they do crevice gardens all over the world. And Paul Spriggs is from Victoria, Canada, and Kent and Seth is in Colorado. And they built our first crevice garden about 3 years ago, and they're going to come back in April, hopefully, if the border restrictions relax. They'll come back in April and greatly expand it. So that is definitely an art form there.
So the crevice garden is a term I've never heard before. I'm going to have to read about it.
I
want to go back to your expeditions. I'll call them expeditions. When you go out in search of plants to Asia or to South America, how does the planning begin? Do you have a notion of certain plants you want to find, or you just have a notion of certain places in the world you'd like to travel?
Well, fortunately, you know, there's plants everywhere, so generally, but we usually do have some plants in mind that we always have plants in mind that we want to find, or groups of plants, or plants related to plants that we like. We'd like to find an area that we know nobody has been to, and from there we can expand out.
Right, because a lot of places, like China, for instance, there might be one mountaintop that has more plant diversity on it than our entire state of Washington. And a lot of those plants are threatened because they're building tourism destination hotels on the top of these mountains or whatever. And so we just feel a very strong pressure to try to, and we do work with USDA. It's important to point out that we don't just pirate these plants. We work with our agricultural.
We have plant import permits and seed import permits and we, nothing comes home with us on the airplane. Everything gets sent directly with inspection, phytosanitary inspection certificates from the country of origin. Everything gets sent directly to USDA, and then they check it over and make sure that there's no insects or pests or diseases present, and that they're all admissible for entry, and that none pose are on like the invasive watch list. And, you know, here we constantly monitor that sort of thing as well. So
I was wondering about just exactly that, is how you keep the plants down on the farm, not from escaping and making their way down Hastings Avenue to Port Townsend and my place out in Chimicum and the big wide world where they don't belong, perhaps.
It's surprising. I think it was a few years ago, Princeton did a study on, you know, kind of the history of plant introduction in the U.S. and like the percentage of plants that have become invasive problems. And certainly there are plenty of those, but as a percentage, it's actually quite low. So there are groups of plants that, you know, that we just simply don't collect.
Right. You know, if we see something in the wild and it's covering a whole hillside, we're not going to collect that because we know
a disturbed hillside, particularly.
Right. So we're very careful.
So your expeditions, I would think, would put you in touch not only with flora, but possibly with fauna, and possibly even with fauna that might consider threatening to your well-being. I'm wondering what you've encountered. For whatever reason, for me, the first thing that comes to mind are snakes.
This is always the first thing that comes to our mind, too.
We've seen a couple of good snakes, that's for sure. Our last trip we took in the fall to China in fall of 2019, there was quite a colorful little viper curled up in the bamboo.
Wagner's viper.
Yeah, and our guide, who didn't speak English, but it was pretty clear what he thought about the snake, when we were standing there photographing it, he went, "Oh my, what are you looking at?" And we pointed at it, and he went, "Oh, ooh," and ran off the trail. So it's highly poisonous.
And that actually gives rise to another question. How do you work with indigenous populations, the people who live in the places where you go, to find plants and, I guess, for that matter, to avoid the snakes?
Well, we hire a main guide, and then
he works with local guides.
It's usually, you know, we've had relationships with the guides in different areas for a number of years, and they're really good. Yeah. And they interface and make arrangements locally, and then the local people will get maybe a local guide. And so it's really, really slick. In 2003, we were one of the first people to go into Nagaland, which is up in northeast India next to the Myanmar border. One of the first folks to go in with permits legally, because it was such a state of rebellion there. They wanted to secede from India. So there's a lot of fighting among the ethnic tribes and with the Indian government. And we did have a local guide who was a local hunter, and he had a came along with us to protect us from rebels and tigers. And he had a homemade flintlock that took him about 3 minutes to get primed up and ready to fire.
Didn't make us feel all that safe, really. Had some good adventures, that's for sure.
And the folks are helpful towards you. Have you ever, since you work with the same people, do you, and maybe return to some of the same places, do they have plants in mind that they have found that they think that you would want to see?
Yeah, there's in the fellow in Vietnam, he's good that way. He's kind of the main guy that does everybody, you know, and so that's kind of his thing.
And he likes plants.
He does like plants. Yeah. And so we can show him a photo of something and he'll know if it's there, if he's ever seen it. And he's very good that way. Some of the others, you know, not so much, but, you know, as long as they can get us into the area, you can go on the web and look at herbarium specimens, dried plant sheets, you know, that are deposited in various herbarium around the world. And you can see where some of these things have been collected. And so that'll give you a clue where to go, perhaps.
Yeah, we usually have lists of plants that we think are going to be in a certain area, and we're trying to find them.
So I'm thinking that the work that you're doing, and I think this is definitely a meritorious term, is citizen science. That is, you're not affiliated with a university, a college, or for that matter, government. How do you interface with the larger institutions, however, the universities, the colleges, and governments as well? And how well do they receive you?
Well, and that's the thing, you know, is that with increasing sensitivity to sort of protecting national, like plant genetics, for example, that was a big impetus in forming the nonprofit to take this for-profit stigma away from what we're doing. So this is going to helping to put us on a more reasonable footing with people. Our local universities, you know, in this country are great.
You know, yeah, we work with the University of Washington and
with the U.S. National Arboretum. We've brought plants to them, and the director there said, you know, one of the really great things about us is that we're very small, which allows you to be very nimble, and you can, you know, if an opportunity comes up to go someplace, you can do it. He says, you know, it's like a 2-year process.
Yeah, so a lot more red tape to jump through, I think.
So you've earned their respect.
Yeah, I would say so.
And we've provided a few missing links in taxonomy too of a few of the new plants that we've found, and so we have a couple consulting taxonomists who are really excited about plants that we've found, and actually will say, you know, if you're in this area, look for this particular plant because this is one that I really want to get a specimen of.
And a lot of, and honestly, most of these things have no commercial value. I mean, they're of interest to some hobbyists, but in a broad range of things. I mean, we're sure we've collected things with commercial value, but that's not what we're after.
I want each of you to tell me about a single plant that you found that really, really excited you.
I think the one that I think amazed us was to be able to introduce to cultivation, first time it's ever been grown in the world in gardens, was a Magnolia lavelliana from China. And this was, you know, only known from dried herbarium specimens, and be able to introduce a tree of such a major ornamental genus, we never expected to be able to do that. And what we did right away, as soon as we had a seedling big enough to share, is we took one down to what was then Quarry Hill Botanic Garden. It's now been renamed Sonoma Botanic Garden down by Santa Rosa in California, because their whole collection focus is wild collected Asian plants. And they have a really great magnolia collection. So this is a key part of their collection, and we weren't convinced that it would actually be hardy here, so we needed to safeguard it and get it down there. The sad thing is they're warmer than us by quite
a bit. They bloomed it before we did, which is always annoying. You always want to be the first one to bloom a new plant, but But
it turns out it's a small leafed evergreen magnolia with small yellow flowers, and it's gorgeous.
I did not know about your conservancy at all until an email that you sent to the radio station was forwarded to me. And I've already also said that I only grow things that I can eat. Now, let's just assume that I'm not really so stuck on that, that I may want to grow something that I won't eat, just admire and look at, and, or maybe just have something that's special that nobody else has except you. How do I work with you? Do I buy something from you? Can I come to the nursery?
Well, unfortunately, the pandemic has made it so that we used to have a retail presence, but we haven't been open since that all started. So right now, all the locals are picking up at our gate. So you can order online. We have a good website, and you can order online and just pick up on the table by our gate on Hastings. And we're hoping future that we can open up for at least some event-oriented things.
I believe that since you're a nonprofit, you also take donations.
Absolutely. That would be great. And we've got three really big projects that we're working on right now: a new shade garden, a continuation of our crevice garden. And we're just purchasing a database, the same database that's used by all the big botanic gardens.
That allow us to share the information with botanic gardens and researchers much easier.
Yep.
Let's put COVID out of our minds for a moment, and let's assume that we are going to be healthy and well, and you're going to be busy with your conservancy and your nursery. What do you project for it? What do you wish for especially for the conservancy?
What we want to see is working so far. Our plan has been for the conservancy to kind of grow and the nursery to maybe be less preeminent as the conservancy gets on firmer financial footing. This is happening, and we're really pleased with that. So we want to see better staffing in the conservancy, with more outreach to community, with more educational events happening. We're doing a little bit of that now with some lectures online through Zoom, which have been very, very good, I have to say. We're able to get people from around the world doing this for us, and this is really great. And we'd like to see more interaction with botanic gardens internationally even. So we've had the opportunity to share some plants on a limited scale internationally, but we'd like to be able to do more of that.
Yeah, we have a very significant amount of plants here, and we'd like to get to continue on even when we can't do it anymore.
So. And I would say that we're really fortunate with the volunteers that we have. You know, one's also on our board of directors, and he's a PhD botanist, great guy and a good friend. And we have, and he got us a microscope, a dissecting microscope. Real nice one to be able to look at our plants very closely for diagnostic purposes. And we've got a great volunteer, Dixie Llewellyn, who comes in and uses the microscope, takes photos, microscopic photos of diagnostic features of some of our plants. And this is providing an important photographic record that we can, you know, they're digital, so they can be sent all over the world to researchers. So that's fantastic.
Kelly and Sue, I need to thank you for this conversation. I have been talking with Kelly Dodson and Sue Milliken of the Far Reaches Botanical Conservancy and also Nursery. We talked about them both. Next week on Attention Please, Larry Stein will interview two new leaders in our community, in the arts community, Kathleen Garrett and Danielle McClellan. Kathleen is the Exhibitions Director of Northwind Art, and Danielle is the Executive Director of the Port Townsend Film Festival. Thank you for listening. I'm Phil Andrus.